Hello there, and welcome to KDL's Stump the Librarian podcast, where your friendly neighborhood librarians put their research skills to the test to answer questions from you, the listener, or a fancy chef, or your teacher. I'm Jill, and I'm here with Liz. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Jill.
We love answering your questions, so please send them to us at kdl.org/stump. Or email us at stumpthelibrarian@kdl.org. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love it if you followed the podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. When you follow and like our podcast, more people can find us. All right, here's the top of the pod question for you, Liz. This one is from a Wyoming listener, and she turned in so many questions into our box at Wyoming, and we may research one of them for a future podcast, but this one is a top of the podcast question. Liz, do you like cupcakes?
In general, I think cupcakes are really beautiful. I'm not a big cupcake eater. Like, if it has a filling in it, I'll eat the middle part. But
you just eat the middle part?
I would just eat the middle part, if I'm going to be honest. How about you?
That's funny. I think cupcakes are really pretty, and I do like cupcakes. They're not my favorite dessert, but I like a cupcake.
Okay.
Yeah. That's a great vanilla question. A vanilla one.
Really?
Yeah, I'm boring. I like the vanilla.
Okay, well, but usually the vanilla ones are the prettiest on top.
That's true.
I don't know.
They're really decorated.
Great question.
So thanks, Emmeline, for that fun question. We like cupcakes, turns out.
Yeah, sure. Especially if they have filling.
Do you have a question from a listener today, Liz?
I do, Jill. I have a question. This question comes from Oliver, who is 9 years old from Granville. And Oliver asks, why do some foods taste salty and some taste sweet? It's a great question, Oliver. Jill, I already know the answer to this, but I will ask you anyway. Do you have a sweet tooth?
Oh, yeah, I totally do.
Or are you more of a salty person?
Ooh, well, I like them both, but I definitely have a sweet tooth.
Because you love chocolate.
I love chocolate, yes.
Love chocolate. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great.
Except not on my cakes.
Of course, that would be silly.
Yeah. Or an ice cream. I just like chocolate.
Just
like
chocolate itself.
Chocolate, okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to talk a little bit about why maybe you like chocolate.
That sounds exciting.
I am more of a salty gal. I like a salty snack more than a sweet. But mm-hmm. A lot of people are like one or the other, you know? Mm-hmm. First, we're going to talk about how taste buds work. So I started my research with KDL's database, Britannica School. It's really searchable. I looked up tongues. I looked up taste buds, but you can adjust the reading level for the article that you're looking at. So you could have really, really basic information to more complicated for middle school and high school researchers. So Britannica School is a great resource. I found out a human tongue may have 2,000 to 8,000 taste buds.
Wow.
And each taste bud has between 50 to 150 taste receptor cells. Can you do the math?
No.
To figure out how many? It's a lot of taste receptor cells. The actual number of taste buds you have on your tongue might be very different from your best friend at school or even somebody in your family. And where your taste buds are located on your tongue can vary from person to person. That's why things do taste different depending on who's eating the food. We need our sense of smell to taste food too. Olfactory receptors in the nose send messages to the brain about how foods taste. That's why it can be hard to taste food if you have a cold. Our taste buds are replaced every 2 weeks, but older people's taste buds don't get replaced. So as people age, not only their sense of smell might go, but their sense of taste might decline as well as people get older. So those little bumps you feel on the top of your tongue, can you feel them right now, mm-hmm. are called papillae. I think I'm saying that right. They contain taste receptors, and they secrete saliva to help you taste your food, chew your food, and swallow your food. You have to have spit in your mouth in order to taste food. The taste buds themselves have tiny little hairs called microvilli, which send messages to the brain about how things taste. So there's five different tastes the tongue can detect: sweet, salty, sour, bitter, and umami.
That's a great word.
Such a fun word to say. The sense of taste is called gustation. Lots of great vocabulary.
Yeah.
Gustation. And it helped early humans thrive. I read a book called Cat Eyes and Dog Whistles by Kathy Evans. It's a nonfiction book about your senses. And sense of taste helped early humans tell them what they were eating and whether or not they should eat something because they didn't always know. So if something tasted sweet, it might tell them that that food would have calories in it, that it would be nourishing. A sour taste might mean a food has different vitamins, like vitamin C in it has a sour taste. Bitterness is a sign of poison. Did you know that?
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
So why do we choose to eat it?
Oh, we'll talk about that. Okay. And salty could mean there's more minerals in a certain food. So early humans use their sense of taste to stay healthy and to stay alive.
Yeah.
So you said you like chocolate, Jill.
I love it.
So did you know sweet things like chocolate actually release endorphins in your brain that make you feel happy?
Now I know.
You have to be careful not to eat too much of a sweet thing like that, because that's not always good for you. But that's like, it gives your brain the signal that everything is going to be A-okay.
Thank you, chocolate.
Thank you, chocolate. Salty is something a lot of people enjoy in snack foods. Sometimes a bland meal, you might think, just needs a pinch of salt. But too much salt can really ruin a food as well. Sometimes that's all you taste if something's super salty. Sour, like lemon and vinegar flavors, add acidity to food. Do you like sour candy?
No, but I do like sour food.
Oh, okay.
Like I don't know, like a lime? Is that a sour food?
Yeah, sometimes.
Yeah.
Well, like sour candy is a combination of sweet and sour. Yeah. So sometimes those combination foods can be really appealing too.
Mm-hmm.
Bitter flavors are probably the least desirable because it's literally a brain signal that something is poisonous. Like that's hardwired into your brain.
Mm-hmm.
However, bitter and sweet can go hand in hand. So that's why adults sometimes drink coffee with a slice of dessert, mm-hmm. because the two flavors balance each other. So what is umami? Just say umami because it's so fun.
Umami.
It's described as a brothy or meaty flavor. The word is from the Japanese language and translates to delicious, savory taste. We taste umami in foods that are high in an amino acid called glutamate. Mushrooms, meats, and even Parmesan cheese have an umami flavor. So what's your favorite flavor? Everybody has like a favorite flavor.
I don't know, because you need all of them.
You need all. It depends on what you're eating, I think.
It does.
Oh, by the way, things that are hot or spicy, that's not one of the flavors that we talk about. They're your body's reaction to pain by something called capsaicin, which is found in chili powder. So whether or not your body can handle that pain from the capsaicin kind of tells whether or not you like a spicy food, you know, like that spice.
That's
some people really like something hot, like something that's going to make you sweat. But some people don't because their body can't tolerate it.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
That is interesting.
Have you ever heard something described as mouth-watering?
Yeah, I have heard that. Mm-hmm.
Our sense of taste is connected to our involuntary nervous system, or the way our bodies react to things without us having any control over it. So if you smell something that's delicious to you, like maybe a hot cheese pizza, your saliva gland starts secreting spit because your brain is anticipating how great that thing is going to taste.
Oh.
Or maybe you don't like the smell of something, like, I don't know, the smell of cooked broccoli. Maybe that, it might actually make you feel sick because your brain is saying, oh, I don't like that food. So it's all connected.
Interesting.
Did you ever hear that there's a tongue map? We're going to do a little bit of history right now.
Oh, no. I never heard that.
Okay. Well, it's a myth. A long time ago, in 1901, a German scientist named Dr. Hennig stated that different parts of the tongue taste different sensations, salty, sweet, bitter, sour. There was just four. While it's true, the distribution of taste buds affects how things taste to people. It's not localized to those parts of the tongue, and they thought it was. Just to add to that, in the 1940s, a psychology professor named Boring mapped out the tongue. Like, you can look at a picture of where he thought different parts of your tongue tasted different things. Like, you only taste sour on the tip of your tongue, that kind of thing. But it's false. You can taste any flavor on any part of your tongue. But the one exception is the taste of bitter things, which is most prominent in the back of your tongue. Probably to stop us from swallowing bitter things that could be poisonous.
Like coffee.
Like coffee. Well, that's a lot about taste buds. I hope that answers your question, Oliver. Taste buds and saliva and your brain, it's all working together to help you taste different things. And that's the end.
It was really fascinating.
Taste buds. Yeah. Who knew?
I knew very little about taste buds.
I learned a lot.
So that was exciting.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
Do you have a fact of the day for us now, too?
Oh, my gosh. It's like a doubleheader here.
You're just going to keep talking.
We'll just keep rolling here. So I do have a fact of the day. This book is called The Maps Book, The Ultimate Guide to the History and Use of Maps.
And it looks really cool.
It's really cool. It's by Lonely Planet Kids. So Lonely Planet is like travel guides and things. I think a lot of kids and adults are just fascinated by maps. Maps are really cool. When I open a book that I'm going to read, like a novel, and there's a map in the front
it's
of it.
So
like,
exciting it's if there's so a map.
Exciting. Okay, it's not just me. So if you really like maps, I would highly recommend this book. I'm going to read a little bit about making fake maps.
Ooh.
So maps take skill and time and money to make and print, but sometimes publishers take shortcuts by reproducing existing maps in books and atlases without crediting or paying the original map maker.
Ooh.
So copying. One of the easiest ways to prove that a map belongs to a particular maker and catch out the copier is by including fake streets, villages, and towns, or by including small inaccurate changes to rivers, roads, or other features that wouldn't exist if the copier had mapped the land themselves.
Ooh.
These fake features have appeared on all kinds of maps, including many modern digital maps. So it's still happening today. But here's a little cutout from that page. Villages that appear on maps but don't exist in real life are called phantom settlements.
Oh.
Some are small mapping errors, but others are traps. In the 1930s, the American mapmaker Otto G. Lindberg and his assistant Ernest Alpers created a trap town on a map produced for the fuel company Esso. They named it Aglo, which was just an anagram of their initials, and they placed it north of the town of Roscoe in Sullivan County, New York. A store was built there in the 1950s, and called the Aglo General Store after the name on the map. When another map maker, Rand McNally, put Aglo on their map, Esso tried to sue them for copying, but they failed as the building of the store meant the place was now real.
Oh.
I thought that was fascinating.
That is really interesting.
So if you like maps, check out The Maps Book found in our Places section of the nonfiction.
That's cool.
Fascinating. I love a map.
Me too.
Okay. Do you have a question for us, Jill?
I do have a question. Wow. And this question is from Nora at the Wyoming branch. And Nora asks, why do people say ladybugs and four-leaf clovers are lucky? Oh, Nora asked a whole stack of questions too. I think these two friends came in together and asked a bunch of questions, which is super fun.
That is fun.
And I want to ask Nora's other two questions right now because they're really easy. Here, are you ready? Can you speak Icelandic, Liz?
I cannot.
No, yeah. Me neither. Okay. How many fingers do you have on your feet?
Zero.
That's a trick question. I'm glad you got that. Nice job, Liz. Wow. Thanks, Nora, for trying to trick us.
Two for two.
I know. How many fingers do you have on your feet?
That's funny.
It's a good one. Okay, this is a fun question, Nora. Lucky is a very interesting concept. Liz, can you think of other examples of objects that have been considered lucky, either in history or today?
Like a rabbit's foot is considered lucky.
For sure.
Maybe a heads up penny.
Yep.
Is lucky.
Yep.
Those are the first two things.
Yep. Those two came to my mind too.
Or a just horseshoe. Crossing your fingers.
Yeah, like, crossing your fingers.
Can be lucky. Uh-huh. A horseshoe, yeah.
A cricket.
Oh, haven't heard that one.
Yeah, I think that is in Chinese culture. Mm-hmm. Things are considered lucky in different cultures, which is interesting.
Sure.
So I found a study on belief in luck that was conducted on children in 2008. So it's already a little bit of an older study, but a very similar study was done in 1999 and then even before that, and the results were similar. So it kind of seems like this is not an area where there's a lot of change that's happening. I am curious about what a study on luck would look like in 2024 if children still believe in luck. So this study from 2008 showed that children ages 4 to 10 were highly likely to believe in luck. The study broke down the data by age, which I thought was interesting, because it showed that as children got older, they were less likely to believe in luck. For example, 88% of the 6-year-olds reported they believed in luck, and by the time they were 10, 60% of them believed in luck, which is still a lot. It's
right.
More than half, yeah. But it is significantly less, which I thought was interesting.
They've been jaded.
Yeah. I don't believe in luck anymore. Yeah. Different cultures do actually believe differently about luck, which we talked about with the cricket. We have different lucky charms. We have different lucky traditions. So for some things like ladybugs and four-leaf clovers, it's difficult to pin down the origins of that lucky object, because often it's really old history and it's passed down by storytelling rather than writing.
Folklore.
Because, yeah, mm-hmm. it often happened in a time before people were writing things down, and then it would just be passed down by oral tradition and at some point perhaps written down. So when historians have to sort out the past, they just have to decide what is the best answer based on the available evidence. All that to say, I found the best available answer to the question, because the real reason that people say both of these things are lucky today in 2024 is because it's been passed down by storytelling through many generations that they were lucky.
Yeah.
And there's an origin story for both. And there's enough evidence for me to say the ladybug one, I feel pretty certain about. And the four-leaf clover one, I don't know, but I'm going to tell it to you anyway.
Okay, let's hear it.
So these lucky charms may have lost their original meaning, but here are the stories I have. Ladybugs first. Ladybugs are a group of beetles, also known as lady beetles, and there are about 5,000 different species of lady beetles. Ladybugs can be found almost everywhere in the world. They're predators. They eat aphids, which is great for gardeners because they will eat the bugs in your garden that might eat your garden.
Sure.
And in fact, there's some places that you can buy ladybugs to add to your garden. And I got a lot of the information from a zoo website, and I linked that here. But the zoo, it's a San Diego Zoo, I believe, they let ladybugs out to eat the aphids at the zoo. Ladybugs eat a lot. An adult ladybug can eat up to 75 aphids per day.
Wow.
Just spend their day eating.
They're so tiny.
I know. It's a lot of aphids to eat. Their bright red color lets other predators know that they are not tasty. Just like in our world, we know when things are bitter. That's color is something for predators to know. Don't eat something that's red.
Right.
Some ladybugs, remember there's 5,000 different species, so they're different. But some of them can squirt out a stinky spray if they're being attacked. And some of them are just protected by the fact that they're red, and others of their species can squirt out a stinky spray. Their color might add to our idea of luck, though, because in some cultures, red is considered lucky. So it's possible that that's one of the reasons we think they're lucky. But here's the best lucky origin story. During the Middle Ages, a large aphid outbreak occurred in Europe. Farmers were worried that their crops would be destroyed and that there would be a famine. So the Catholic farmers prayed to the Virgin Mary for help. According to legend, after the farmers prayed, a swarm of bugs appeared and ate up all of the aphids, saving the crop. The farmers and all the people thanked the Virgin Mary and started calling the bugs Our Lady's Beetles. Oh. And over time, that was just short to ladybug or lady beetle.
Interesting.
Yeah. There are a variety of lucky beliefs about ladybugs from different times and countries, and I'll give you just a few examples here, but there's really a lot. In Victorian England, if a ladybug landed on your hand, you would be receiving new gloves.
Oh.
And if one landed on your hat, you would be receiving a new hat. In Switzerland, people told their children that they were brought as babies by a ladybug. That's funny, isn't it?
That is kind of funny. But ladybug is so tiny.
Awfully smaller than a baby. And in Sweden, if a ladybug lands on your hand, you will be getting married soon. Okay. In India, a ladybug in your home means your house will have good fortune. And there's so many more. Well, we're going to shift now, though, to the four-leaf clover.
Oh, nice.
Like with a ladybug, there are multiple species of clovers, less though, about 300 mm-hmm. different species of clover. The four-leaf clover of good luck fame has the scientific name of Trifolium repens. The tri part of that name means three. So this plant commonly has three leaves that are heart-shaped. You may have heard of this plant also called a shamrock. Mm-hmm. It is specific to this particular clover. And clover grows everywhere. Mm-hmm. This particular clover is native to Europe and Central Asia. But now, because it grows so nicely and it's quite pretty and attracts bees and good things you want, it can basically be found everywhere in all grassy areas over North America, Australia, anywhere that there's grasslands, you can find clover and this particular kind of clover. The four-leaf clover is a rare variety of this plant, which can sometimes have a rare variety of five leaves. That looks pretty weird. I saw some pictures of it. The four-leaf one, well, I guess it just looks like a good luck charm, right? Which right. I've seen so many times. So there was a study in 2017. It counted the four-leaf clovers all across Europe in several different countries and to figure out how rare four-leaf clovers are. And the study found that it's about one in every 5,000 clovers. So it's rare, but it's not as rare as was once thought.
Mm-hmm.
And botanists, those are people who specifically study plants, they don't actually know why the plant sometimes has four leaves instead of three, of course.
Of course.
Thankfully, that's not the question this right. time. So it is believed that the plant can carry a recessive gene that results in four leaves. So if you find a four-leaf clover, you should look around and see if there's another one because there may be others that are related to that plant really close. But they're not entirely sure if that is why. Sometimes they have four leaves because the plant is really only supposed to have three. But why is it considered lucky?
I don't know.
Maybe because it's rare. Yeah. Maybe because it's cool. Because
they don't all have.
They don't all have okay. them. Right. Oh. Yep. Well, hundreds of years ago in Ireland, Druids, who were Celtic priests, carried four-leaf clovers as charms. The four leaves represented faith, hope, love, and success. So that is one story about it. At that time, it was also believed that a child carrying a four-leaf clover could see fairies.
Okay.
I know. Try it out. See if it works. The first written reference to the four-leaf clover being lucky happened in the year 1620. And I'm going to end this question with reading the first written quote from Sir John Milton. And this is what he said. If a man walking in the fields finds any four-leaved grass, he shall find in a small while after some good thing.
Well, that's wonderful.
Thank you, Sir John, from 1620 for that luck.
Wow.
I know.
Fascinating.
Yeah, I did actually look through that book that you referenced. I can't remember a few episodes ago mm-hmm. about good luck charms.
Yeah, that was a cool book.
Yeah, it was a really cool book. And it doesn't have the origin stories in there.
No.
Which, you know, and part of that is because it's hard to determine what is the origin story. So I can understand why they wouldn't be in there. Mm-hmm. But it did have a lot of information about what some cultures think about both ladybugs and four-leaf clovers, among all tons of other lucky objects.
Yeah. It's really interesting to see how other cultures determine whether or not something is lucky or good luck or bad luck. And
it is
different everywhere you go.
It is, which is really interesting.
It's cool.
Well, I have a book I've been reading. Well, I cheated. I have three books.
Jill, we don't have time for that. Pick your favorite.
So this month I read three books with characters, featuring characters with autism.
Okay.
So one of them was a chapter book, one of them was a book and verse, and one was a picture book. I am going to talk about the picture book today. I promise not. I'm not just going to talk about all of them, but I do want to give honorable mention. So I'm going to list off the other ones. Honorable mention to The Fire, The Water, and Maudie McGinn, which is about a girl who spends her summer with her father and the rest of the time with her mom, who doesn't understand her. But this summer, she learns to surf and understand herself. That was a good one. Yeah. And then I read Good Different. That's the book and verse. It's about Selah, and she learns to write poetry that she's writing in the book and to express herself. That's a sad one. It made me cry.
Oh.
So fair warning on that one. But I want to talk about the picture book. It's called A Day with No Words by Tiffany Hammond. It's just a very simple day in the life of Aiden and his mother. Aiden uses a talking device to communicate with his mother. And this book shows how Aiden can communicate with his family and the outside world just without spoken words. Aiden faces bullying in this picture book at the park, and it's not from other kids. It's from the other parents. And when I read that, I know that this is something that some kids face because they might seem different. And I want to read to you what the mother said to the other's mothers, because I think it's awesome. And it's really what made me love this book. I already liked it, and then I got to this page and I loved it. She went up to the other mothers and she said, "My son does not speak, but his ears work just fine. The words that you say go straight to his mind." She was a really good protective mother. Mm-hmm. I really like to read books that help me understand how people experience the world differently than I do.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I like it in a picture book.
Sure.
It was short. It was easy to read. I thought the pictures were beautiful. And you told the story even more than the words. It was very simple words. So if you want books with characters that feature autism or anything, really, you can talk to a librarian.
Absolutely.
And we will help you find them. This is just three books that feature characters with autism, but there are more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I just happen to read all three of them.
Nice. Recently. Thanks for those recommendations, Jill.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Do you have anything you'd like to share that you learned today?
Oh, yeah. I thought I knew about the five senses, but I don't think I knew very much about taste at all.
Mm-hmm.
I knew the five taste words, but I did not know that everybody had different taste buds and that they are vary where they're located. I also didn't know the name of the sense of taste, gustation.
Gustation.
That's a great word.
That's a great word.
It's a new vocab term for me, and I like it.
Awesome. Well, I learned about ladybugs and how they squirt a stinky smell. I guess I never knew that before. That was a new little trivia tidbit for me.
Yeah. You wouldn't think a lucky creature would squirt something stinky.
No, but, you know, nature is fascinating. So
it is.
That's great. And I like that other ladybugs maybe benefit from the ones that it's kind of like poisonous animals. Like if they mimic the color or the pattern of another one, like then they'll also be,
protected
from predators. So.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, nature. So fascinating.
I agree.
Well, I guess that's it for us today. Thanks for all of your amazing questions and helping us to learn more about our world, too. For more information or to send us your own question, head to kdl.org/stump. Tune in to the next episode where we answer even more of your questions. A huge and special thanks to the KDL Programming Department, the KDL Marketing Department, and JD Delinsky for our intro and outro music. Thank you.